As a subcommittee, the Republicans are in caucus. We're going to start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 318, and I'd ask that Marsha Lori and Morena please come forward. And then after one of these individuals has testified, then Tessa Sage, I'll ask to come up after that to replace that individual, and we'll see what we have before us here. So I'll let you decide who's going to lead off for us.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Marsha Keith, and I'm here today testifying on behalf of the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association. The OVMA was the requester of the bill, and we requested the introduction of the bill for the Veterinary Medical Examining Board. And the reason that we felt it necessary to introduce the bill and that we were happy to do so on behalf of the Veterinary Examining Board is that it became apparent after a much publicized incident with a veterinarian in Banks in Washington County that the Veterinary Medical Examining Board in the state of Oregon did not have the authority to sanction or take action against a licensee whose mental or physical condition impaired the licensee's ability to practice veterinary medicine. If the incident that was involved had nothing to do with the specific practice of veterinary medicine, that is, if it was outside the scope of veterinary medicine, but was behavior that clearly would raise questions about the person's ability to safely practice veterinary medicine. Most of the other, in fact, virtually all of the other, I believe, health examining boards, regulatory boards, have the authority to take action against a licensee whose behavior is clearly indicative of impairment, whether or not that behavior is actually practiced as in the practice of veterinary medicine. So we were happy to introduce the bill on behalf of the Veterinary Medical Examining Board. The realization that this was a gap in the authority of the examining board came after the deadline for state agencies to submit bills. Otherwise, it would have come to you as a veterinary medical examining bill with our support. As it is, it's our bill, and we have the executive director of the Veterinary Examining Board here to go into further reasons why the bill is necessary. So I'll turn the rest of the testimony over to her, unless you have questions.
Let's go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I'm Lori Mockinen, director of the Veterinary Medical Examining Board, and I really don't have anything to add to Marcia's testimony. On behalf of the board, I would like to thank Marcia and the OVMA for bringing this forward because, as she said, the issue came up after the deadline for agencies to introduce concepts. What I would like you to do is take a look at the amendments that the board is asking for approval on. And the first one is, and this is on the second page or on the reverse side of the sheet that I gave you. In the last session, we added a board member. And in section one, it says, with the consent of four members, we'd like to change that to five so that we don't ever have a tie situation on disciplinary matters. This would require a majority or quorum of the board to make disciplinary decisions. We've also added language in 2A that not only allows the board to make decisions based on competency evaluations, but gives the board the authority to direct a licensee to have a competency evaluation. And that's pretty much all I have. I'm happy to answer any questions. Oh, one more thing. There was an article in the Oregonian yesterday that refers to this as the Matlock Bill, That's not the way we characterize it. This is a bill that would affect any situation where the licensee's suspect conduct is not done in the context of veterinary practice, but is felt to present a potential threat to patient safety.
Okay. Mr. Boone may still want to call it that. So
That's his privilege.
Why don't we proceed, and then we'll ask questions. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, hello. My name is Marina Schmang, and I'm basically representing the public. I can speak from personal experience that I believe this Senate bill would be a very good bill to pass. I worked for a veterinarian for 2.5 years, and I had seen many mental and physical violations, and we have submitted through an attorney on June 4th, 2004, a complaint to the Oregon Veterinarian Board. I believe since they're so restricted in all of our efforts to pass this bill would give us where our hands aren't tied. I've witnessed many eyewitness accounts of this. The man has a mental condition. He plays God. He says that he would, with a needle in his hand, he can give life or death to the animals. I've witnessed abuse for 2.5 years. And he also illegally uses drugs. And I believe this bill would support the public in order, our complaints would be, I guess, more heard and addressed. If this bill were to pass, I don't know if I can mention names, but he does have Parkinson's disease, and over 2.5 years I've witnessed him unable to have the hand-eye coordination necessary to perform simple surgeries, and I believe that this would allow the people, I feel in all of our efforts that we've tried to stop this man from practicing, and he has been in violation before in another state. I believe that this would help the Oregon Veterinarian Board take measures as to take his license away, because I don't feel he would never, relinquish his license voluntarily, and I believe this bill would help us to be able to take necessary action.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. McKinnon, let me just clarify. So, based on your testimony and some of the materials you provided, the veterinary board in this one instance had someone who was abusing animals, but because of the fact that they weren't directly under their care, even though they had demonstrated their lack of proper care for animals, you were unable to take action like other medical associations would have done under similar circumstances in their own professions. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and members, that essentially is correct. Our attorney advised that while, we could have issued an order, it would not have had any basis in our practice act. We didn't have anything that we could look at and say we're going to suspend your license based on violation of any rule or statute that we currently have.
Okay. Questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair, if someone was actually convicted of animal abuse, what could the veterinary board do?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monis Anderson, we do have a statute that allows us to take action if there is a conviction for animal abuse. But because of the potential time frames that can be involved, in fact, I think she was charged in October. She was scheduled for the criminal trial this week, but that has been postponed, and we don't know when when that will happen. So the board feels that waiting for a conviction, which can take a long time, is not in the interest of animal patients or the public.
Thank you.
Senator Scar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Reading the ORS 686-120 that's in the bill, it's already current law. What's the definition of unprofessional or dishonorable conduct in line 8.
I guess the
add-on to that question is, it seems to me that depending on what that definition is, this particular circumstance would be covered or apparently isn't, but if there's a definition of that somewhere, that would be interesting to know.
Sorry, you're going to have to help me look at what you're looking
at. I'm looking at the bill, Senate Bill 318 on line 8.
Right here.
ORS 686-1201. Basically says, with the consent of four members, the Oregon State Veterinary Medical Examining Board may discipline in accordance with ORS 686.150 any permit or license holder under this chapter for unprofessional or dishonorable conduct, period. So it seems that's pretty broad authority under the first paragraph.
Right, Mr. Chair. Senator, sir, 686.150 reads, if I can just read it briefly, if pursuant to 686.120 and 135, the board determines that disciplinary action is necessary, the board may take any or all of the following actions: revoke, suspend, or refuse to renew the license, put the licensee on probation, suspend execution of an order of the board, place limitations on a license, issue a reprimand, require board-approved community services, or impose a civil penalty. What this goes to is, and again, this is the interpretation of our Attorney General, this applies in a situation where a licensee is practicing veterinary medicine. In the case that brought this issue forward, the licensee was not practicing veterinary medicine. And yet, again, because of the evidence that the board had as a result of its continuing investigation, which included interviews, even though the precipitating event wasn't veterinary medicine, the board felt that if this individual were allowed to continue to practice veterinary medicine, which she was working as a veterinarian at the time, there was a possibility that harm could be done to animals.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
So the unprofessional or dishonorable conduct is qualified somehow, at least by the Attorney General, in the direct occupation of practicing veterinary medicine, even though it doesn't say that in the statute.
That's right. That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, I think as I was looking over the statute, and what Ms. Mackinnon is saying is that the dishonorable conduct, which relates back to 120 from the other statute, is specific to conduct all itemized under the practice of medicine, so that they can starve their own animals. That doesn't count. If they were starving someone, if Senator Starr took a horse to a veterinarian and starved that horse, then they could take this action under 150. But if they starved all their own horses, and even though that was an indicator that they may not be the kind of person that would want to be able to practice veterinary medicine, that gave him that loophole. Am I interpreting that correctly?
That's correct.
Okay. Other questions for these witnesses?
Interesting.
Justice Sage, you want to add anything to this?
Yes.
Well, come on forward.
I'm with her. Can I just sit here?
Sure, yeah, wherever the comfort zone is.
Hello. Good afternoon. Take a breath.
Take your time, state your name, and where you're from.
My name is Tessa Sage, and I'm a resident in Portland, Oregon. Whew. I am in favor of Senate Bill 318. I strongly believe that the Oregon Veterinary Medical Examining Board and the Oregon Veterinary Medical Association need to have the authority to discipline any permit or license holder of veterinary medicine as they see needed. Veterinarians who fail to abide to the oath that they have taken to provide the ethical, responsible, professional, and humane care of animals need to be promptly restrained and penalized. Bill 318 will empower and give control to the proper and trusted authorities so that timely action may be taken. I am a veterinary technician myself, and I have personally witnessed many animals who have been victims of serious abuse caused by a veterinarian in Portland, Oregon. He is also a repeat offender and is still physically, mentally impaired and currently deceiving the public of the harm and abuse that he inflicts upon his patients. his license was suspended, and he spent prison time for severe animal abuse. He is still currently practicing. A fully detailed report was turned into the Oregon Vet Board in June of 2004 by an attorney whom was hired by several citizens and witnesses who reside in Oregon, who demanded an investigation of the inhumane treatment and abuse to their pets caused by this doctor. If Bill 318 was a law, then I believe that the Oregon Vet Board and Association could have already taken immediate action against this veterinarian and other vets who have committed such violations. Instead, these cases, along with many others, are postponed. Please pass this bill to ensure the taxpayers and concerned citizens of Oregon that the fully expected reprimands may be fulfilled by the entrusted and appointed authorities of the Oregon Vet Board of Examiners and Medical Association. I believe it's what they have been hired for. Please let them do their job and allow them this expected right in order to perform at their fullest capability. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? Members, we've had a request from the board to add amendments to this bill that are on the back of the one testimony. Two ones, one talking about a medical evaluation that would be a trigger for action by the board, and also a request to change the 8-member board to a 9-member board at the request of the board to avoid tie situations. Anyway, that would require, of course, we would draft amendments for that. If the committee is amenable to that, we would hold that and give them an opportunity to do that. Okay? Well, with that then, I will ask that the advocates work with the committee administrator, Teresa Van Winkle, in short order to prepare those amendments, and then we will bring this bill back at that time for further discussion. So with that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 318.
Thank you.
And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 209. And let's see. And ask that Cheryl Pellegrini please come forward. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini, and I am an Assistant Attorney General with the Oregon Department of Justice. We've prepared written testimony to support Senate Bill 209, which is the Department of Justice's, we call it the Disaster Price Gouging Bill. This bill has been introduced in various forms for the last several sessions. The change in this session's version is that it is narrower, both in the triggering events, which are limited to
line 13, I think.
Yes, it's fire, flood, earthquake, volcanic activity, sabotage, and act of terrorism or war. It also is limited at the other end in terms of the types of transactions to which the bill's restrictions would apply. And it's restricted to essential goods or services, which mean residential construction, including building materials, services, and supplies, food, medical services, and supplies. And we've pared the bill down in the hopes that we would address some of the concerns that have been raised previously, that the bill was just too broad in scope, both in terms of the events that might trigger it and in what it covered. We have had some limited experience in the past in Oregon with price gouging in the wake of disaster. The most recent that comes to my mind is that there was flooding that occurred, I believe, in 1996. Up around the Jervis area, And in the wake of that, FEMA was called in by the federal government. And one of the first things that we saw there were itinerant unlicensed contractors coming in and selling people services that they either didn't perform properly, or engaged in some other sort of deceptive act or practice. Other states, of course, have had more recent experience, and Florida's experience with the trio of hurricanes this past fall is all still fairly fresh in our minds. There, Attorney General Crist filed several lawsuits against motel operators that were found to have increased their prices over 250% right after the hurricanes. And it's been Attorney General Meyer's position that it would be prudent public policy in this regard to not wait until after something has happened in order to give the Attorney General the ability to step in and stop a practice which occurs much quicker than the market itself can correct. I would point out that currently in Oregon there is no price gouging law, and sellers here are free to sell goods for the highest price that the market will bear and a willing consumer will pay to a willing seller. And that's been the policy decision of the Assembly. The argument's been made that the same sort of market forces would move to correct any instances of price gouging in the wake of disaster. But as we look around to the experience of other states, what we have observed is that the market does not react that quickly, and that there is always a window of time, and there are always citizens who are harmed by the profiteering motives of a very few. It's that premise upon which this bill is based. I can go through maybe some of the essential parts of the bill. I would also note that along with my written testimony at the back, there's a chart that lists the current states that have price gouging bills, the triggering event for the terms of the law, and then the penalties. And I believe that, in 2003 when we testified, there were 21 states, and there are currently 27 states plus the District of Columbia that have price gouging laws in effect. Some of them are triggered by, as this one is, by a specific declaration of the governor or by the Legislative Assembly. Others, I would note, there's no triggering event at all, and they are just a purely a price gouging, anti-price gouging bill. Senate Bill 209, it would require a declaration by the governor of an abnormal disruption of the market. Now, this is different than a declaration of an emergency event. So a declaration of an emergency would not trigger these provisions. And the declaration and the provisions would go into effect only after a declaration that met the requirements of subsection 3, which is that the governor would have to proclaim an abnormal disruption of the market and would have to specify the geographic area covered by the proclamation, and may not specify an area larger than necessary to effectively respond to the abnormal market disruption. The declaration would also have to contain a date and time at which the disruption of the market commenced. And such a proclamation by the governor could be terminated by two events. One, by proclamation of the governor, or second, by act of the assembly. Upon such a proclamation, Section 4, those provisions would become effective. What they essentially do is that they set clear guidelines for merchants to be able to charge a price that is necessary in view of perhaps an increased cost for them to procure goods or services, or to respond otherwise to pressures that the market may place on them. But what it does is it sets an amount certain at which a price for an essential good or service would be deemed to be unconscionably excessive. And that standard is that it would exceed by 20% or more the price at which those particular goods or services were sold or offered for sale by the contractor, merchant, or wholesaler in the usual course of business immediately prior to the proclaimed abnormal disruption of the market. And you will notice, if you look at the chart later on, that of the five states that set caps such as this, you'll notice that the cap they set is 10%. And we thought that 20% might be more appropriate, so that's the cap that we have set. Others don't set a cap at all. They say that it should not be unreasonable, and that would have to be litigated to determine what that is. So this provides more certainty to merchants and to the public. I'd also note in Section 4, Subsection 3 provides affirmative defenses to a claim of a violation. If a merchant or seller demonstrates that the price increase is attributable to additional costs imposed by the merchant or contractor's wholesaler, or was necessarily incurred in procuring the essential goods or services during the proclaimed abnormal disruption, there would be no violation. And as well, if the increase had no relation at all on the event that triggered the declaration, then that would also be an affirmative defense. And in the way that the Attorney General's office would investigate these is that we would be seeking statements from the merchant to determine the cause of the price increase in the course of our initial investigation. I'd be happy to take any questions. We would urge this committee to consider this legislation and to approve it and send it to the full floor with a due pass recommendation.
Ms. Pellegrini, and by the way, you're the only one signed up to testify, so I'm curious as to, I recognize the narrowness of which you have presented this bill this session. Could you tell me who the Department of Justice worked with on this bill to reach this this product for this session, some of the other individuals the department worked with based on previous objections? Did you seek out others to work this piece of legislation on, and who might they have been?
Mr. Chair, do you mean others outside the department?
Yeah, those who objected to previous versions of this bill.
No, what we did not, Mr. Chair, seek out anybody prior. What we did was in the 2003 session, this bill was then Senate Bill 825 that was introduced by Senator Walker and Representative Merkley. It received a hearing, and the chair of that committee directed the department to work with there were several industries and representatives that expressed concern. We were directed to meet with those people and receive their concerns. We did that. We took notes. We decided not to go forward given some of the concerns. So in drafting this, we looked back at those meetings, what we learned from those meetings, and tailored the bill accordingly.
Okay. And I realize that it's also an affirmative responsibility of others to comment when you provide this information. Of course, this is a public record, too. I just find it interesting that no one has signed up to testify. So, by the way, if you oppose the bill, don't come tell me later about that, because you're going to have an opportunity to testify on this now. Questions for Ms. Pellegrini?
We have no representative of the price gouger. Oh, here.
Question for Ms. Pellegrini. Senator Starr.
Thank you. Question I have is, how would the department feel if we amended Section 3 of the bill to require in the governor's proclamation that the proclamation lasted a specific period of time, and if he needed to reissue the proclamation, then he could do that at the end of the deadline, rather than leave it open-ended? I don't know. I could foresee a situation where something happened to the governor and it took a while to get the new governor installed or something, and in the meantime, everybody that's in the area is living under this declaration. I don't know. That's just one thought.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, I think that is that's a very good idea. As I said, in most instances of disaster price gouging that we see, it happens immediately after an event. And you're right, it is very limited in time. There is a window within which most of it occurs. After that, things do tend to settle a little bit. Market forces come back into play, and then the market may once again begin to regulate prices. So I think, I mean, assuming that the Attorney General would approve, I certainly would recommend such an amendment.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a very valid point.
Yeah, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In your testimony, you talked about past instances. You mentioned the flood in Jervis, and you mentioned unlicensed contractors coming in and really operating illegally in the state, because it's illegal today to be offer contracted services and not be licensed. That's the question. If folks are today are unlicensed contractors and breaking the law, what's to prevent them? I mean, you, the CCB, you have all the statutes to award the harmed parties the opportunity to go after folks that are operating illegally. How is this any different if folks could, you know, if they're breaking the law today, they could break the law under this? What's the difference between what this affords the Department of Justice is and what the enforcement capabilities we have today if folks break the law?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, I think that Mr. Ebersole will talk a little bit more about unlicensed contractors and what remedies we have available today and what we believe we need in addition. And that perhaps was not the best example to give you. It was the one that came immediately to mind. To answer your question directly, unlicensed contractors are subject to civil penalties by the Construction and Landscape Contractors Board. But I think that a difficulty that the board has had in using that particular remedy to curb an unlicensed contractor is that there's really no good effective mechanism to make the unlicensed contractor pay the penalty, civil penalty. And they're free, well, they're not free, but there are many unlicensed contractors, and these are people who have never been licensed, not people who mm-hmm. whose license simply has elapsed, who continue to operate in the face of an order imposing a civil penalty. And unless the board marshals its resources to begin collection proceedings to collect from that person, and sometimes they don't have money that, you know, that their financial status is such that the proceeding wouldn't be indicated, then the board doesn't have a whole lot of authority. In those circumstances, they have turned to us, and we have applied the Unlawful Trade Practices Act to stop them from what they're doing.
So my question is, how is that different than what this bill would afford the Department of Justice the opportunity?
As for unlicensed contractors, we probably could get at them. But as for other types of sellers that may not need a license to operate within the state and are simply taking advantage of a disaster event to raise prices for no other reason than they can command that particular price in the wake of that event for a short period of time, there's not much that the department can do. We could, theoretically, we could bring an action against such a seller under the unconscionable provisions of the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. That requires a fairly intensive investigation because essentially those are common law principles. And it would take us, I would submit it would take us a while to marshal sufficient evidence to bring into court to stop the practice, by which time the person may be long gone and the damage may already have been done.
And I think, I appreciate that answer, but that seems to be the situation you'd be faced with under this bill as well. I mean, the damage will have been done, and folks that are going to break the law and price gouge are going to do that, and you're going to be left. But this just provides you additional teeth in the law to go after those folks. Is that, am I getting on the right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, it does provide us additional teeth, but what it really provides us is an immediate access to a judicial process to be able to stop the conduct. Because we have that 20% trigger, we can look at the price that's being charged, determine whether or not any of the affirmative defenses exist, and if not, we could immediately seek a court order rather than trying to show that the price was unconscionable in terms of all the other facts and circumstances that may have been present at that time. which is what the situation that we're in now.
Senator Deckert.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Pellegrini. Just one, or just maybe two questions. One is just on page 1, line 27. And I guess the only concern I have, and maybe perhaps it's not a concern, is that the language that's used in line 27 and 28 may not specify an area larger than necessary. To me, that just seems vague. And governor's proclamations are, I mean, if you look throughout the country, they're one thing that governors can do, and probably effectively most of the time, to respond and to show the public that we're responding to this natural area. But I guess the thought that I had is maybe you would define it by 10 square miles, and even if it's a flood, that gives you some, I guess, parameters in place so that Gervais flood would be a good example, so that too large of an area is not being impacted. And but you're shaking your head, so I'm assuming that...
I'm shaking my head, Mr. Chair, Senator Deckert. I think that that's certainly an amendment that we could consider, is looking to more specifically define it. We certainly could try to draft an amendment to address that.
All right.
Other questions, sir?
No, thanks.
Oh,
maybe not.
Well, no, Mr. Ebersole just passed a note saying that one of the prior bills had a...
90 or 180-day cap on the term of the period of the...
That's the term. We're talking about the geographic. We're talking about the geographic. The geographic reach, not the time.
No,
if you're going to comment, why don't you come up forward here? We're getting a little astray now. Please identify yourself. And
Chairman Metzger, members of the board, my name is Eugene Ebersole. I'm an assistant attorney general for the state of Oregon, have been for the last 15 years. This bill is sort of my fault because in 1991, the late Senator Roberts came to me and asked me to draft it, and it was much broader back then. And that was in the wake of the earthquake that we had up at Mount Angel. And that's the biggest concern we have here. Senator Deckert, I, with all due respect, I don't think the governor would declare an emergency for a 10-mile zone. My concern is more that we have one of the largest earthquake faults going right down the center of the city of Portland. And, you know, I think the recent tsunami and the earthquake in Indonesia show us that the earth is a very fragile environment, and we live very secure in our day-to-day lives, not knowing when that big one is going to hit. And my biggest fear of being a citizen in Oregon and living in the valley is that that earthquake is going to happen one of these days, where the top of Mount Hood is going to pop off. You know, we can get another volcano. I went to law school.
Mount Hood is not going to blow up.
We hope. We never thought Mount St. Helens was going to blow up either, sir.
Don't not tell the senator from District 26 that we're going to have an impending disaster.
But that's the kind of catastrophe this bill is meant for. It is not something that's aimed for. I don't think the governor is going to declare an abnormal state of a disruption in the marketplace for a 10-mile flood, because you can drive outside the 10 miles and buy your bread and buy your supplies. It's that earthquake that's going to hit if it hits, and it's that hurricane that got in Florida that comes on without expectation. It's a catastrophic event that this bill is really aimed at controlling. And one of the great advantages of having the Unlawful Trade Practices Act to tie into it that stops it, where we have the tool to stop it, is that we are able to file an immediate legal action and file a motion for a temporary restraining order and an order to show cause. And the rules of court require, for the defendant's sake, that we have to be heard. They have to have a hearing within 10 days. So that we would file affidavits stating this 20% and the disruption in the marketplace, and then within 10 days the defendant would be able to go into court, and then the burden then would shift to them to say, well, we had to charge 20% because I-5 was broken in half and we had to take the product and ship it all the way through Kansas to get it to Portland because the rest of the road was broken, which would be a valid defense, as opposed to saying, hey, I saw an opportunity to gouge Oregon citizens. And that's what the bill is aimed at. It's unfortunate, but it's true that there are a small percentage of businessmen, and sometimes who are otherwise legitimate businessmen, will take advantage of a situation when there's a catastrophic event. And that's all we're wanting to do here, is to protect Oregon citizens against those very few people in the world that would take advantage of those of us that could be harmed, and our constituents that would be harmed in the event of a catastrophic event.
Other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, does anybody want to represent the price gougers here? All right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. Just a few points, and I think you've actually, in your questioning of Ms. Pellegrini, have covered some of those about trying to find ways to tighten up how this would actually be applied, the timeline, the area. Those are all very important. The examples that Ms. Pellegrini used, for example, the hotels. Hotels are not covered in this act, as best as I can tell. I think it might have been Senator Starr. I think he pointed out that how does this put teeth into the law, or how would this add additional teeth? I think this would actually would cause a great deal of litigation, because what prices retailers pay manufacturers is pretty competitive information. We are talking about one retailer versus another, and they may be one or two of the nation's largest retailers are going to pay a substantially different price to a manufacturer. And so the 20% might actually apply to one retailer who wasn't even actually gouging, just because of the deal that was made, depending again on how you develop the evidence in the trial or in the court case. So, you know, retailing has become very competitive. I will note that retailers are very much into reputation management. It's a national trend, especially with the nation's largest retailers. And I think you see, if you looked at the Florida hurricane, it was the retailers who stepped up. They actually paid, took relatively large hits on providing supplies to people that were harmed in the hurricanes prior to and immediately after. I will note that there are the Oregon economy, one of the things that's doing very well right now is certain parts of the building supply industry, because they're rebuilding towns in Florida. And so that's just how competition works, and it does serve a valuable purpose. So additional constraints, I think, would be very helpful to us. It's not that we have any great opposition to the bill. We just like to have it further tightened down a little bit, I think. We're not actually price gougers.
So, just so I understand correctly, other than the suggestions that have already been made in committee, are there any additional ones?
I think I want to take, Chair Metzger, I think I'd like to take a look at that 20% figure and just take a look on how it applies to the competitive nature of the commodities provided to retailers and the competitive nature of the retail community.
Okay, because I think just, you know, arm's length looking at this thing here is that, you know, you've got competitive natures in the normal business cycle. We're talking about an overnight event in which things will escalate.
Sure.
And, you know, there's a lot of states, including our neighbors, California and Idaho, who have these provisions. And I see it as two major advantages. Number one is there is that the public pressure. So if someone has been noted for exceeding under a catastrophic event, price gouging, just the very fact that that might be publicly recognized, I think, has a certain restraining effect on certainly legitimate businesses would have that. And secondly, I think the Department of Justice, if we're looking at what we're talking about here, an act of terrorism or a major Earth-related event, that with the number of situations that materially could evolve, I would think the Department of Justice would be very, very careful about wasting their time on ones that that weren't clear. But knowing that they would have that option, have that ability to something that was clear and unmitigated response to a disastrous event, you know, whether it be to AOI members, you know, businesses, and or to us as individual citizens, you know, there would be a certain restraint to that. So I appreciate those comments. I think this is an important you know, piece of legislation. I think the comments that Senator Starr made about limiting the time so that we don't you know, have an an ongoing situation without reaffirming it, making sure that we don't unnecessarily expand the scope of it, I think are valid and mm-hmm. would certainly entertain those type of amendments. Questions for Ms. Brandes? What I would ask to do, first, is there anybody else who would like to testify on this bill at the moment? Do you have a question, Senator Starr?
I'd just be curious. I see the representative of the Building Industry Association in the back of the room. I'd just be curious if the have any comment on this bill. I obviously haven't signed up. I just want to know.
I think that's you, Mr. Berry.
We are going to talk on the next bill.
Okay. But Senator Scar's question, did you have any input on this bill? Would you like any input on this bill?
Not at this time.
Not at this time. Okay. Well, maybe your only time. Okay. Thank you very much. I think what I would ask to do is, Ms. Pellegrini, would you please work with Senator Scar on a time frame and Senator Deckard and suggestions in terms of the geographic area so that we have a comfort zone here. I would also ask that you make an effort to discuss with the representative from Associated Oregon Industries their concerns and see if we can find a ground that what people will feel comfortable with so that we can make those proper amendments. But the chair's desire would be to move forward with this piece of legislation, so I want you to know that. So if you will have input on that, I think that's valuable and important, so let's do that in a constructive way, and then we will bring this bill back at that time with proposed amendments to discuss. Senator Stark.
I'm sorry to drag this on.
No, go right ahead.
Go on, but I'm just reading, again, as I scanned some of the other states, you don't specifically mention petroleum in this bill, and other states clearly line that out as an item. Is there a reason why that's not included?
That's, Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, that has been a major obstacle in every single other version, and so we're trying to just pass a narrow version that limits it to food, medical supplies, and building supplies, which relate to personal housing, and to just start there.
Okay.
And, that's not to say that petroleum would not be nice, but
fair enough.
We need to start somewhere.
Okay.
And I will, Mr. Chair, I will do as you have directed.
Right, and then work with Administrator Van Winkle, too, and we'll bring this bill back at that time.
Thank you very much.
So, you bet. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 209. And let's see, what's next on the agenda? We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 213 and ask that Eugene Ebersole and Michael Snyder please come forward.
It's gas. People trying to get out.
Welcome again, and welcome.
Well, fine. If you're working with them,
just name my name for the record again, I guess. My name is Eugene Ebersole. Excuse me. I'm an assistant attorney general for the Oregon Department of Justice, and I've been so employed for over the last 15 years. During my 15-year tenure with the Oregon Department of Justice, I have spent a great deal of my professional endeavors in working for the Landscape Contractors Board and the Construction Contractors Board. As a matter of fact, they've probably been a client of agency of mine for probably 12 or more of those 15 years. In the course of my job, I have continually gone out and filed lawsuit after lawsuit and injunction after injunction against unlicensed contractors, both landscape contractors and construction contractors. And both for two reasons. One, to enhance the protections for the citizens of the state of Oregon. As we all know, that licensed contractors are required to have a bond and insurance, which affords a claims process that is very effective and works very well for our citizens when they have problems with their contractors. The unlicensed contractors run without this insurance and without the bond, and very often are sometimes nothing more than highway robbers that take the money and run. Some are itinerant, some are just people that seem to stay around Oregon and move from place to place and take advantage of people and take their money and don't do any work. Whether it's the ones that are sort of semi-thieves or the ones that just don't refuse to get licensed and bonded, the problem hurts consumers and businesses. And where it hurts businesses, especially in today's marketplace, as you're already aware, I'm sure, the insurance problem for contractors is just enormous right now, and it's probably the most serious issue that's facing contractors in Oregon today. and it becomes therefore much more difficult to maintain that license and much more expensive. So by allowing unlicensed contractors to continue to operate puts the honest contractors at a serious disadvantage in the competitive marketplace. And this particular bill I have found in working with the Contractors Board is, I feel, very necessary for a couple reasons. And that is, it's always easy to go after a contractor who's unlicensed, who makes believe he's licensed, says he's licensed, shows a phony ID number, puts a phony ID in the phone book or the newspaper. But then we have the more astute unlicensed contractors who have been operating for quite some time, who have been penalized in the administrative process by the Contractors Board over and over again, and yet still continue to try and ply their trade. And what happens is that they don't say they're licensed, but they allow the consumer to assume they're licensed, because unfortunately many and most consumers do not do what they should do in due diligence like a professional would, and then with that call the Contractors Board and find out if this contractor is licensed or not. He appears licensed, he has a truck, he's got his name on it, gee willikers, he did Joe's house across the street and did a good job for him, or the wood lumber company down the block, so when I asked him if they knew him, everybody said they knew him, and maybe they knew him from 5 years past when he was a good licensed contractor. For whatever reason, this unlicensed contractor goes face to face with an Oregon consumer who assumes he's licensed. Well, why would he make that assumption? Well, because in order to be a contractor in a state, the consumer knows you must have a license, you must have a bond, you must have insurance. So therefore, they get a job, and this contractor either does some of it, all of it, or none of it. And it has a claims process, and it is only then they find out they have no recourse. What this bill does is it makes it a per se violation of the UTPA to operate as an unlicensed contractor, either landscape or construction. That saves the department and both of the boards when they direct us. And under both the Landscape Contractors Board statute and the Construction Contractors Board statute, they have a specific provision which they direct the Attorney General to take action on their behalf to stop this activity. These cases that I do for them almost always tend to be the repeat offenders. I can think of only a handful of cases in the 15 years I've done them where it's a first-time offender. Those are better taken care of in the administrative process and usually are. I bring to mind on my written testimony I've given you, there was a recent contractor who had unique or not so unique political feelings, sometimes identified with a group called Posse Comitatos, where they don't believe any of the laws in the state apply to them, and this is a repeat offender. And this gentleman, after numerous cases of getting fined, had to be stopped. And I filed the action, twofold action normally I file. I file an unlawful trade practice action, and I file it's an action under either the LCB or the CCB injunctive provisions to stop the contractor immediately from doing work. And this contractor spent $40,000 of the CCB's money in what I would call ridiculous arguments, but because the court gives deference to pro se litigants, and he was a pro se litigant, it cost over 2 years, and probably by now it's about $50,000 of the Contractors Board's funds to try and get him out of business under the injunction. Now, he may still continue to operate, and I may need to take him for contempt. But by having a per se violation for operating unlicensed, it will create an extremely valuable tool that the Department of Justice and the Contractors and Landscape Contractors Board need to bring a halt as quickly and economically and judiciously to this type of practice. I would note that this legislative body 4 years ago in session specifically created a budget note in the Contractors Board statute to create a unit and to work with the Department of Justice to eliminate contractor fraud in this state, which they did very effectively. They started a special investigative unit, and I started a small, I was appointed to be a leader of a small unit at the Department of Justice in which we do nothing but take CCB's money and effectively go after these unlicensed contractors and construction fraud. This bill is an aid to the legitimate contractors. We have no intention of using it in any way on a legitimate contractor, for instance, who has inadvertently forgotten to renew their license. And that doesn't become a problem because when they renew their license, the boards reinstate their license retroactively back to the date that their license lapsed, so there wouldn't be a legal violation anyway. This is not a tool that is going to be used for any purpose other than to try and go after these unlicensed contractors. And I note that the legislature 2 years ago, in a like fashion, added the unlicensed car dealers to the UTPA for similar reasons, those two being the two industries, construction and car dealers, where unlicensed activity is a really serious epidemic problem in the state.
Thank you. Let's have the other testimony, and then we'll ask questions.
Thank you for having me come, Chair Metzger and members of the committee. I am Michael Snyder. I am the administrator for the State Landscape Contractors Board. We're a semi-independent agency. I've been administrator for 2.5 years. We are here to support this bill, primarily because it gives a tool to the Department of Justice for habitual offenders that violate the statutes of the Landscape Contractors Board. We pay Gene dearly to do this for us, and this tool will save us money, we believe, in the long run. Thank you very much.
You pay him dearly. That means a lot. questions for either of these gentlemen? Okay, thank you for now. We may have some more questions. Let's ask Scott Berry and Sean Miller to come up. And Stephen Cafori, why don't you come up as well? We've got three seats there, and these are the other three that we have signed up to testify in this bill. Scott, why don't we begin with you?
Sounds good. Members of the committee, good afternoon. Scott Berry on behalf of the Oregon Home Builders Association, formerly the Oregon Building Industry Association. I don't know how many times we're going to change our name, but hopefully not too many more. We have some, I think, some early concerns about this bill. I don't know that in the end, after spending some time with the folks from the Department of Justice, we'll end up opposing it. We signed up as neutral. But I just wanted to point out that, first of all, our licensed contractors would like nothing more than to get rid of those folks who are unlicensed and working without a license in any capacity. We think the Construction Contractors Board has been very effective at doing that, and I think all our interest is with this bill is determining what is the problem, what's the scope of the problem, and is this the best tool to go after it. One potential concern might involve a licensed construction contractor who would be putting in sod on a home that they own and are building for sale. So anytime they reach over $2,500 worth of landscape work, that's their limit, then they're now into landscape contractors board stuff and could be fined for that. Whether that rises to this level of fraud across the $2,500 threshold, I'm not sure that it does or that it should, and this tool should, in our opinion, I don't think should be available for that. It is, as we read this bill, whether the Justice Department would go after that, they may say no today, but it's difficult to tell. They certainly would have the ability to. So that's a concern. We have some other concerns on cross-licensing in terms of once a contractor does any sort of other work outside of the scope, again, we rely on BCD and the boards at the Building Codes Division to take care of those civil penalties. So I think our main point is just let's work within the process working very well, which is the Construction Contractors Board, to make sure we're staying inside that, and we'd just like to spend some time working with the Department of Justice on making sure this is the right tool to go after those folks.
So if I can paraphrase what I think I heard from you, Mr. Berry, is that, and I'm familiar with the organization, is very concerned about keeping non-licensed people from competing with, because that's part of the cost of doing business, and that's not that's an unfair advantage, and they have been very supportive of that. But you want to make sure that inadvertent crossing the line of different occupationals or scopes of work that don't get somebody in an unintended trap of being fraudulent, like you say, landscaping, and making sure. So if there was a comfort zone, either through discussions with the Department of Justice or amendments that would add that comfort, that this was not a hammer for those types of situations you described, you would more likely be comfortable with that bill if that was could be achieved to your satisfaction?
Chair Metzger, I believe that's correct. We just have those concerns with inside the scope of licensed contractors, because there are so many different licenses out there. And once you cross a licensed contractor cross into somebody else's work, that process for fining and penalizing those folks is already in place.
Okay. Let's go ahead, Mr. Miller.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I represent the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors, and we also signed up as neutral. We wanted the same questions to be vetted in the committee. Scott mentioned the mission of the Construction Contractors Board, and that is to protect the consumer. We've been very supportive over the years of making sure that they have the tools to go after these unscrupulous contractors, and they are out there. We just wanted to make sure that it's done within the realm of the CCB, and it's not done something that's separate than the CCB. And I understand from our conversations before the hearing that Mr. Ebersole said, you know, they only get complaints from the CCB, and he works upon that. And I think those are the kind of issues, you know, as a comfort level that I think we'll be fine with. I want to give the committee an example of something that we've been working on in the interim, and Scott mentioned the other trades, and as you know, the CCB licensed contractors, but the Building Codes Division licenses contractors and trades as well, for instance, the electricians. That's another separate agency, plumbers. There's other different contractors that are also licensed, and one of the things, that, and the bigger issue, not only is being able to get these unscrupulous contractors, but actually finding them as well. And you know, one of the issues we discovered following last session was, you know, these people, when the inspectors are out there Monday through Friday during normal business hours, that's not when these folks are normally working. They work at night. They'll work the night shift overnight, or sometimes they'll work weekends. You'll find them Sunday working on a project when no one else is really working. We actually, one of my clients, the Independent Electrical Contractors, in conjunction with NECA and IBEW, actually privately funded a pilot project with the Building Codes Division to hire a private person to go out and look for some of these unlicensed contractors. It's been very effective because this is somebody that doesn't have to stick to the Monday through Friday business hours. They're going at night and on the weekends through tips through our contractors and actually getting a lot of these unlicensed contractors. And so, you know, one of the things we've been looking at in the future is maybe looking at a way to more look at some being able to get a private element in this, because, you know, the state is, you know, unfortunately constricted into those kind of hours, Monday through Friday. And again, from our industry's perspective, and we do want to get those folks, that's normally when they're not working. And so, you know, again, our comfort level, I think we will be able to work this out with attorney, with the AG's office. But you know, I think there's a bigger issue, and that's actually getting some of these folks, too. And you know, we'd be interested in working on that as well. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
So, Mr. Corr, why don't you comment, and then we'll take
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Corry. I'm here today representing the Oregon Remodelers Association. We are instrumental in establishing the Construction Contractors Board for a couple of reasons. One was at that time, and still to, a little bit to this to extent to this day, the term remodelers has kind of a shady term, a shady connotation, and the people are sometimes afraid to have someone come to work on their home because they hear all these stories about people coming in ripping them off. So we wanted to make sure that the reputation of the profession was upheld, and we think that has happened. The other thing we're worried about, not only the competition with people who don't have insurance and bonding, but people who don't have workers' compensation, don't pay unemployment, don't pay their taxes, those folks can save a whole lot of money and it can then give those prices to the home builder that, I mean, to the homeowner, that's hard for us to compete with. And so the competition is very unfair, as you just heard. 4 years ago, the Attorney General put forth a package of bills to deal with this problem, and some of them went a little further than we were happy with. And matter of fact, they wanted to make some of these things criminal offenses and put people in jail for them, which could have been, you know, kind of over the line kind of questions that you heard Mr. Berry talk about. We met with the Attorney General Myers and folks from the AG's office and did negotiate out a process whereby the Attorney General would step in after the CCB had done what they could do, so they weren't being operating as two separate agencies, and I think that it's important that that be maintained. I know that the Attorney General has continued to make sure that our folks are happy with that arrangement, and so far the arrangement has worked. We know that there are some people in the AG's office who are very aggressive about going after folks, and we want to make sure that their aggression means is maintained within the boundaries. And if that happens, we're very supportive of this bill.
Okay. Questions for the committee? Senator Decker.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So, Sean, just they cannot work on the weekends of the folks that we have. I mean, if we need to change the statute for that, that seems to me prime territory to allow.
Mr. Chair, Senator Decker, I think those get into collective bargaining agreements with state employees, and so, yeah, we're willing to look into those issues, but that's always been our challenge in addressing some of the collective bargaining agreements that the state employees have on their hours of work. And I think, again, normally in those hours of in their collective bargaining agreements are normally the times in which these people aren't doing the work.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Decker, if I may add on to that, one of the things that bringing these folks under the Act, the Consumer Protection Act, is that it would allow a private right of action, so and attorney's fees. So a homeowner could sue directly and get attorney's fees if they were harmed. So in some extent, the person who's harmed by after hours would get the benefit of the private action that you're talking about.
Well, I mean, Mr. Chair, it just seems to me that, I mean, if this might be, instead of doing a new bill, I mean, it seems to me this might be part of the solution, whether we, and I don't know what we can do contractually with but going forth, if the state said we want private investigators or we want the state employees to be out there when the folks are out there, seems to me a better solution, if that's the problem that we're trying to get at, than, I guess, harnessing the AG's power to really aggressively go after folks. To me, that just seems like a better solution.
Mr. Chair, Senator Decker, I don't think that they're necessarily one or the other. I think that this problem is severe enough, and the people who are harmed badly enough that we need to use all tools we can.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair, Senator Deckard, I'll comment on the pilot project that, again, was funded by NECA IBEW, and we're very supportive of that project. It is a pilot project because they want to see the success of it, and if it is successful, which we already know it is, because the guy has paid for himself and more in penalties, in not only into the division, but it's gotten a lot of these folks that are unscrupulous. And this is just for the electrical license. But again, when you apply this private project, what we're trying to prove is that I think this can be brought out and implemented and slowly into, you know, into these other areas of licensing and on making tape, probably in a budget process, using some portions of the budget to fund maybe some of these private. And I'll tell you, retired state police officers are very good at this.
Other questions? Okay, a couple things. I think addressing Senator Deckard's question, yeah, I think we are looking at two things here. We're looking at the strength of the action against unscrupulous contractors, as well as locating them, and then also what can we do once we locate them. You know, I think it is very interesting, Senator Decker, your point about on the second point, that is the ability to identify these folks. And I think that's worth exploring, too, if there's any limitations on that. Certainly through the collective bargaining process, I don't think people are limited to not working on Saturdays, other than that those terms and conditions need to be negotiated. Or if there's some difficulty there, we could provide additional authority for others. And in fact, that was not the case. What I would ask is, again, I think from what I have heard is that people are overly supportive of this, but they have concerns about overreaching into some areas. And so the Attorney General representatives in the room have heard all the testimony, and you're going to be very busy. I would ask that you talk to the representative of the AGC and the building associations and others about either providing a higher comfort level or what level of amendment would provide that comfort level so that we make sure that legitimate businesses are not subsidizing the work of those aren't, but that we don't provide maybe tools that are overreaching and have to come back 2 or 3 years later and saying, hey, we thought they were just going to do this and they're using the heavy hand unnecessarily. So if you would work with them, try to resolve some of those issues, and when we hear back from you, we will consider bringing that back. Senator Starr.
Can we have here, I have a question for Mr. Ebersole.
Yes, please. Mr. Ebersole, would you please come back forward?
He has a comment as well. The question I have, Mr. Chair, is
yes.
For Mr. Ebersole, is has the CCB endorsed this? We heard from the landscape contractor report.
Chair Metzger, Senator Starr, CCB is taking a neutral position on this because they want to make sure that they don't get in trouble with their constituents. Mr. Miller's concerns have been their concerns as well that we've talked about. If I could clarify one thing, I respect Mr. Miller and Mr. Berry's opinions, but they kind of went pretty far afield of what this bill is about. Two sessions ago, this body gave the contractors board, using the Department of Justice, an entire toolbox and a methodology and a directive, which was go out and stop this problem and do it now, and here's the money to do it. This bill is not a sledgehammer. This bill is just a surgeon's knife that's going in that toolbox. We've already got the powers, and we are already doing it. The things that Mr. Miller mentioned about the electricians and the building codes people, this has nothing to do with that. This is strictly landscape contractors and construction contractors. They're talking about licensed electricians, licensed plumbers, the building codes division, DCBS. That's a different department that handles different sets of enforcement. That we have nothing to do with that. Is not involved with this bill or our project whatsoever. I'm more concerned about Mr. Miller understanding that and the overlap. The problem is there is an overlap between LCB and CCB. There's some work that landscape contractors can do that is traditionally construction contractor, and there's some work that building contractors can do that is traditionally licensed landscape contractors. And that has always been a problem throughout its history because sometimes it's easy to see the far ends, but sometimes when you get into that point where you go from $2,500 to $3,000, and those are things I think we can work out, if not even in the bill, maybe by administrative rule, so that administrative rules sometimes are much better at clarifying things. You can say a lot more. You can put official commentaries. You can get a little bit more verbose that makes it clear. Where this bill is strictly to give us a tool on those unscrupulous, repetitive contractors who don't, who ply their trade making people think that they're licensed.
Okay, that's good. Again, though, I'd like to have you work with these folks. I want to, they're obviously clearly supportive of making sure that their contractors, who are paying these fees and are licensed are doing the job. You want to make sure, as they do, that these repetitive, unscrupulous people have additional tools, but we still have this clarity or lack of clarity on this, and I want you to work to see that we find clarity or we identify where the problem is and what we might do to remedy that. And at that point, we would then consider bringing the bill back, okay?
Also, one thing I want to make sure you understand, too, is sometimes you say things and people don't clear things up. Mr. Miller had mentioned that we get all our cases from contractors board. We don't get all of our cases from the contractors board. We have a hotline, and consumers call us up all the time, and many times they call us up with construction cases. Part of our program is a review and referral system that has been working very effectively for 4 years back and forth, looking at how the cases come in, working with CCB, and determining how that we're going to prosecute it. Sometimes CCB does not want to fund the case and says, no, this is strictly an Unlawful Trade Practice Act. You pay for it, Department of Justice, and if it's the right case, we do.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Eppersall.
Just one other comment, and that is that all of the folks licensed under the Building Codes Division, electrical, plumbing, et cetera, elevator, are also licensed with the Construction Contractors Board for their liability insurance and bonding.
Okay. So you'll work with Mr. Eppersall and Stephen Eisenclair. Thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 213. Members, would like to open a work session for introduction of committee bills. Teresa, I believe we have a bill we'd like to introduce as a committee bill.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, committee members, there are actually two LC drafts in front of you for consideration. LC 254 is at the request of the Oregon Home Builders Association. It authorizes a contractor to present for recording and construction a contract that contains information related to construction defects and express warranties. The other LC is LC 2644, which is at the request of the DCBS Insurance Division. It revises requirements of insurers relating to the use of credit employment history or insurance scores.
Okay. Again, members, introduction of committee bills does not indicate support or opposition, but we would entertain a motion to introduce these as committee bills.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move LC-254 and LC-2644. Be introduced as committee bills.
Senator Starr has moved that LC-254 and LC-2644 be introduced as committee bills. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing now on Senate Bill 309. And let's see. Well, we have one proponent, so let's bring the proponent first to set the stage. And Tom Lindstrom.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and the Senate Committee. My name is Tom Lindstrom. I am the president of Beaver Creek Cooperative Telephone Company. Beaver Creek is 100-year-old. Last year we celebrated our 100th year in service. Just a brief introduction of what a co-op is. It's strictly owned by the members. We're a nonprofit company. We serve our members. Our members elect board of directors who then hire management. I am not a member of the co-op. I was hired by our board of directors, and I've been with Beaver Creek almost 24 years. So basically, Senate Bill 309, and I have passed out an amendment that we would like to make to the bill, and we have not passed on to the Legislative Council. Some of the people that will probably testify this afternoon, we have presented this amendment, and we also presented it to the Public Utility Commission this afternoon, because there were concerns that Senate Bill 309 was attempting to do more than what our intent was. Beaver Creek is a cooperative, and anytime you deal with a co-op, it's hard because dealing with postal boundaries, dealing with school boundaries, dealing with some of the cities and the annexations of the cities, and as a co-op expands its territory, you could either expand as a co-op or you could expand as a competitor and not as a co-op. And currently today in the state of Oregon, Beaver Creek Telephone is the only company that of the 11 co-ops that has expanded their boundary and is operating as a true co-op. You can only be part of our co-op if you buy telephone services from it, and therefore share in all the profits and return all monies to our members. And basically what this bill is going to do, and some of the problems that 759025 has caused, Beaver Creek Telephone is busy expanding its services into Oregon City. Part of our service, original service territory, is Oregon City also. And in fact, I would say the majority of our members today live in the Oregon City Postal, Oregon City School District. And as when we expanded into Quest territory of Oregon City, and trying to explain to existing members and new potential members of, you know, the co-op philosophy and what it is, and being a co-op and how we can serve them, then competing with Quest, stating that really they're not offering you service as a co-op. You know, they're identified as a competitor by the Public Utility Commission, and don't let them confuse you. And we are serving Quest territory as a competitor, but we are serving them as a co-op. We do not serve as a competitor or a CLEC on a non-regulated type basis. And this bill will help clarify that. Once we have our certification, which we have for Oregon City, it basically, what this bill is saying is the board of directors can adopt a resolution. We then take our boundary maps into the commission, and we then officially say that this boundary is within the co-op serving area. It does not change anything with 759020 of our competitive status. It doesn't change anything really in 759025. We still go through those rules. And also with 759500 to 570, where it says that we have state authorized the allocated territories. With this bill, an approval from our board as well as the commission, it doesn't really change our status of how we receive federal funds. We don't receive federal funds today in this territory, and we wouldn't receive them in the future of ETC status. And we are confused a little bit why, as you'll be hearing testimony from a couple of the co-ops, why they are opposing this bill. I personally don't think they really understand it. I don't know. We presented this to the OTA Association, and they have chosen to oppose it. And I personally don't think it's because of the content of the bill. It's more, I think it's the content that you have a co-op like Beaver Creek who's truly operating as a co-op and working strictly for its members. And as an example, last year in 2004, we spent $2.5 million expanding in the Quest territory. And some of the heartaches that we're facing is Quest out there. There's the commission, they could adopt a tariff that allows them to what they call a win back, for example, where if we provide service to a customer that likes the quality of the service that we provide, like our rates, Quest is able to offer them a discount for 90 days or 120 days, 6 months of financial incentive to bring them back to Quest. And then after that 90 days, 120 days, whatever, then they go back to Quest rates. And yes, they could come back to the co-op after that, take advantage of it. But it's a confusion to the customer. And we think part of this will help that bill, basically stating that we can't offer you those discounts. We can't offer you those win-back tariffs because we're a co-op. We're a nonprofit. All members basically share the same cost based on the services that they buy. It's a cost-based service.
Mr., sorry to interrupt you, but just so we can kind of narrow the issue here. So what is it about the current process that that is unfair to Beaver Creek that requires this proposal? What is it? Because we have a process that's laid out for your growth. So what is it that you're trying to leap ahead of that is necessary, and why is that necessary, and what is it about the current process that doesn't allow you to do that?
Mr. Chair and Senate Committee, I think it's two things. It's a roadblock to competition, and number two is, as a co-op being non-taxable, I think the biggest issue is, as a co-op being non-taxable, because we currently file under a 501c12, at some point down the road, we believe that the federal government, state of Oregon, might come back and say, wait a minute, maybe co-ops should be paying taxes, or are they really operating truly as a co-op? Because really, a co-op rates are overcharges to the members during the year, and then when you find out what your true cost, operating cost is at the end of the year, and in most businesses that's called a profit, that is not called a profit to a co-op, that's called a distribution back to the members, and give that money back to them based on the money they spent with the co-op. And we're trying to really identify, as we continue to spend money to bring new members on our co-op, and we're a rural co-op, and we don't have the density to help provide the services, we need to make sure that we have a clear playing field in order to compete properly, and also not to worry about any gotchas. And I think when we first brought in 759025 back in 1985, this little piece right here, which I don't think it was thought about at the time, was added, we wouldn't be here today.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Lindstrom?
Yes, Mr. Chair. What is a basic telephone rate for your co-op members without voicemail, without
local? Yeah. Mr. Chair and Senator Moons Anderson, local only is $1.
Can you get that down a little bit? Maybe 95 cents?
Let me explain that a little bit. We have what we call a network access charge. That pays for the cable and wire facilities from the central office to the home. And that network access charge covers cost for local EAS, toll, ISP, DSL. Instead of adding a little bit of component to every part of a service, we're basically saying that all members will pay a network access charge to pay for those facilities from the central office to their home, and then we pay a true cost for local EAS, toll, DSL, internet.
Well, I was just trying to get an idea of what the average household pays for a telephone.
Mr. Chair and Senators Moniz Anderson, I would probably say local and EAS, I think without toll, because toll is toll sensitive, I would say right around $20, $20, $21.
Thank you.
Okay. Other questions, Mr. Lindstrom? Okay, we may have some later. Thank you, Mr. Lindstrom. Well, a couple of your neighbors don't agree, so let's have Mitchell Moore and Keith Galitz from Canby Telephone, Clear Creek Telephone, please come up. I don't know. Should we let Brent Wolf come up?
I don't know.
Okay, Mr. Wolf, now.
All right,
you may come also.
Thank you again. For the record, my name is Brent Wolf. I represent the Oregon Telecommunications Association. As you heard previously, the OTA is opposed to this bill. And rather than hear from me, there are two other cooperative members that share a common boundary with Beaver Creek Cooperative Telephone who are here to kind of explain the rationale and the reasons for the opposition to this bill. And I don't know who wants to go first, but Mitchell Moore from Clear Creek.
Mr. Moore, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Mitchell Moore. I'm the president of Clear Creek Telephone and Television, and we are a cooperative company serving the area of Redmond, Oregon. We provide local telephone, long-distance cable television, directory internet services, and we do that all under the corporate structure of a cooperative. I have just a couple of short reasons why we oppose this bill. Essentially, this bill is really introduced and is a request to provide benefit to a single telephone cooperative in Clackamas County. And under the bill, Beaver Creek, which operates as an incumbent local exchange carrier and a competitor, as they indicated, as a cooperative, would be granted preferential regulatory treatment for its competitive operations. Essentially, there's two definitions of a co-op in statute that defines us as a corporation, as a co-op, and that which defines our regulatory treatment under the 759. And what this bill in effect does is change the cooperative telecommunications service provider who is operating under the business structure of a co-op to provide competitive telecommunications service to essentially a regulatory structure of the co-op. And effectively what that will do is create a unique regulatory environment for that competitive operation, because under previous regulation in the 2001 session, or legislation rather, cooperatives were effectively deregulated from commission authority under effectively everything except access. And the way this is written, it appears as though you'll be operating under that regulatory structure as a competitor. Also, the bill seems to be pretty ambiguous if you actually look at the way it's structured and you look at the treatment of the use of the word cooperative throughout the Oregon statute in the telecommunications section. And I think it's pretty accurate to say it would have taken extensive rework of other sections of the legislation or at least administrative rule. And I think a key point, as it was brought up on the 8515 test, I as well have to meet that test. But it brought to us, as correctly stated, in the Internal Revenue Code in Section 501c12, and there's nothing about this legislation that would change that and make that test any different in any way. It's basically hard-coded into that for telecommunications service, and it doesn't have anything to do with whether you're competitive or not. And finally, this legislation, I think, has unintended consequences. It's the blurring of the line between the incumbent local exchange carrier and the funding that we receive from the universal service and the obligation that we provide for providing service to all members of our community. So I would urge you to oppose this bill.
Okay, before we ask questions, let's let Keith chime in here.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Keith Gielitz. I'm President and General Manager of Canby Telephone Association. I'm also on the board of OTA and on the Small Telephone Cooperative Committee, or Small Committee of OTA. And I think, to summarize my testimony, I filed it with you all. It's interesting that not a single other telephone company in the state supports this bill, nor do they see a need for this bill. And I also am a cooperative. I have to live with the 85-15 rule. I'm making decisions every day on whether to enter competitive marketplaces, knowing that I have 85-15 tax issues, but I have to deal with that in my business planning as I decide those issues. And we have recently announced that we're going to enter competition within the next year to the cable company, offering to be the first telephone company in the state of Oregon to offer television over DSL lines. I've also looked at opportunities to compete with other telephone companies outside of my region. I see no reason for a need for this bill, and I, without duplicating some of the testimony of Mr. Moore, would tell you that I think it does create significant conflict between the Federal Telecommunication Act, the State Telecommunication Act, and also the Federal Income Tax Act. And I don't believe a conference call with the OTA Small Committee, when Tom described what he wanted to accomplish here, the primary focus was the 85-15 rule of the Income Tax Act and how you go about amending a state telecom act and impact the treatment of the federal tax laws is confusing to me. So while my testimony goes much deeper, I think that summarizes my position relative to this bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Wong is here.
Can you just explain a little bit what 85-15 means?
It means that you cannot earn more than 15% of your total revenues from activities outside your telecommunications.
What's the 85 mean?
The 85 is 85%. At least 85% of your revenues have to come from your ongoing business.
Okay.
And this year, one of the activities we did this year actually may put us over the 15% rule. Our income, our accountants are now looking at that, and we knew going into that activity that potentially this year we would pay income taxes if we exceeded the 15% rule. That's the rules, and I have to do my business planning based upon the rules that are given to me. And that's all we're asking Mr. Lindstrom to do, as he competes anywhere he goes, comply with state, federal laws and income tax rules.
Thank you.
Other questions? Mr. Wolf, if you get up your seat a little bit, I'd like Mr. Lindstrom to come back up in the middle here and join. I have a question here. No, the other guys, you guys stay there.
Oh, okay. You're all cooperative.
You're cooperatives, I'm sure, yeah. You like credit unions, right? You all get along, huh?
Right.
So, Mr. Lindstrom, I'm curious as to why the way the bill is narrowly drafted, and if this was overall good telecommunications policy, why would it be written only for Beaver Creek? Why wouldn't you, it's, you know, you're talking about the 86th time, January 1, 1986, why wouldn't this be written more broadly to encompass all potential applications?
Mr. Chair and the Senate Committee, this bill does do the same thing for the whole 11 co-ops in the state of Oregon. It is just not for Beaver Creek. And if I can make a reference to the 85-15 test, as a co-op member, as I serve in Oregon City as a CLEC competitor and bring on a Quest customer, they now become a co-op member. those revenues that brought to the co-op is member, they're part of the 85 test, not the 15%. Where Mr. Kalitz was talking about, where he just announced that he was doing cable TV over DSL, and he's going to do it, I assume, through a subsidiary company, that would then become taxable. We also offer cable TV at Beaver Creek Cooperative Telephone as member-based. It is not a 15% of non-member revenues. It's part of our 85-15 test, and it leans towards 85-15. And so that they could take the same advantage that Beaver Creek is choosing to do. And this is unique within the state of Oregon. When we started expanding in 1996 as a co-op in the Quest Territory, which I like to say is Mr. Galitz is an ex-Quest retired employee, is we could have gone that route and gone as a competitor, strictly as a competitor, and not make it as a co-op. But our board of directors basically said, because we serve 65 square miles of rural territory, anything that we do for a member of the co-op, we will do for a new member coming in from a Quest territory. We want to treat all co-op members the same. So this bill can be the benefit of both Clear Creek as well as Canby. It's if they choose to do it. If they choose not to do it, that's strictly a decision that their boards and their management must make. We will not offer any services in the state of Oregon as a non-co-op. Our board of directors, our 100-year history, has basically said we will not.
Mr. Kalitz, if you would respond to Mr. Lindstrom's point that on the 85-15 test, you were talking about the federal code and his explanation how that really is not circumvented by this or it is applicable by the way in which it is utilized for their business income. What's your reaction to that?
Certainly, Senator, I'd be glad to. First of all, we are going to offer television over DSL as a cooperative. My other activity I was talking about was totally separate from a decision to enter television or video over DSL. Second is, I can do the same thing Tom's suggesting without this bill. I could make anybody I want to a cooperative. I can go out in CLEC and make a cooperative. I don't need this bill to do that. I believe this bill creates significant confusion and conflict among three separate and distinct acts. He's trying to deal with an income tax activity with a bill on a state telecom act. I think there's also rules and regulations on how you go about CLECing into other territories. And I believe this bill will create conflicts and potential regulatory issues dealing with how I go to CLEC. I know what the CLEC rules are. I can go ahead and, the competitive local exchange company rules are. And if I decide to go do that, I deal with the rules. And I have to watch to ensure that I don't in some way use my cooperative dollars to further unregulated activities. But I just believe this bill creates significant confusion. I don't need it. At least 10 of the 11 cooperatives in the state don't believe we need it to conduct any kind of business we might want to enter. There are no prohibitions to our entering business either as a competitive telephone company or competitively in someone else's territory as a cooperative.
Okay, so what we're going to do...
Yes,
Senator Deckard has a question first.
In some ways it's more of a comment, but it falls under the rubric of beware of what you wish for, because in some ways, to me, and I'm not as familiar with co-ops, but the more I learn about and their behavior as a CLEC, to me, coming from a territory that does not have CLECs or does not have co-ops, to me, you have a distinct advantage over any other CLEC by your tax status. And I'm sure that's the rationale for the 85-15 rule, is to at least provide some certainty to the taxed traditional CLECs and ILECs. But to me, I mean, the only thing this has brought up for me is, boy, we really have to be mindful of our co-ops because they have that competitive advantage over other CLECs. And then the obvious question to me is, that's a federal rule. That's not a state rule. It's not.
Mr. Chair, may I address that for one
yes.
minute?
Yes.
As a co-op, we all face, as a company, a rural company, competition, wireless, DirecTV, digital. I could tell you, we were the first co-op to file in the state of Oregon in 1996, the same time the federal telecom came out. We have lost over $500,000 a year in revenues due to wireless, cable TV, whatever. we have replaced those lost revenues with almost $1 million from Quest territory. Beaver Creek Telephone today is the only co-op in the state of Oregon that offers complete 100% digital cable to all customers, complete 100% DSL services to all customers, and we have three new housing developments that we have fiber to the home that we have already put video over DSL, and we are, instead of offering 1.5 megabits of DSL services connectivity, we're able to offer up to 10 megabits. Without these protections, Beaver Creek would have died. Beaver Creek would not have provided these services that the same people can get in downtown Portland without this protection that this bill gives us. That's
tax,
a fact.
The tax status.
Not just the tax status, but being allowed to go into a competitive territory and compete and bring those revenues across as a co-op member, not as a CLEC or a competitive local exchange, but as a co-op member to replace those lost revenues that allows us to continue to do research and development like fiber to the home. There isn't a telephone company in Oregon today other than Verizon, and Beaver Creek is no Verizon, that is providing that services. We are providing it today, and we have been since October, and we provide voice, video, and cable TV over that video or fiber to the home. Nobody else can do that. We were the pioneer, and we were able to do that because of bills like this. And if I can't have a bill like this, you're tying my hands, and you're allowed. It's making it harder for me to compete with people like Quest. And that's really what it is. It's the tax is probably 50% of it, 49%. The balance 51% is being able to compete against a company like Quest and provide the services to my current rural members as well as my future co-op members.
Question. Because of the interest of time, I'm going to dismiss you for the moment because I want to have an independent party come forward now. So, and that's Lee Beyer, the Oregon Public Utility Commission, is here. And we use the word confusion a lot, so I'm going to try in the last few minutes of this committee to sort out the confusion.
It's nice to be testifying in a bill that isn't ours, I guess.
Welcome, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senators. For the record, I'm Lee Beyer, Chairman of the Oregon Public Utility Commission. As you can tell from the testimonies, anytime you get into the telephone business, it gets confusing. What I'm handing out to you is just to give you a visual representation. The quality isn't real great of the map. What those different colors represent and the different squares is those are the allocated territories in the state of Oregon for what we call ILECs, or incumbent telephone companies. Under the Telecom Act, the Federal Telecom Act, and state law, we identify and recognize two kinds of telephone companies. One of those are incumbent companies, or ILECs, and the others are competitive providers. In Oregon, we have 33 ILECs represented by the colors on the chart there. 11 of those 33 are co-ops. 22 of them are private companies. Obviously, the four big ones have most of the territory, and those are Quest, Sprint, Verizon, and CenturyTel. And a number of the others are small and look and operate a lot like a co-op. So that's a distinguishing feature. The thing that you need to keep in mind is that an ILEC, when they were created, they were the original telephone companies, if you will, before we went into promoting competition. And they get certain advantages and have certain obligations. One of the, their basic obligation is that they are required to provide telephone service to anybody who asks for it, assuming they can pay the bill and all that. But they have to provide it. And the turnaround on that, or the advantage that they get out of that, is they have an assigned territory. That used to be a big advantage before we had competitors, but that's basically it. And they receive from both the federal and the state government different from each, funding from what's called the Universal Service Fund. And the concept behind that is to assure that all Oregonians have telephone bills that are roughly the same. I mean, they're a little bit different, but the idea is that you have affordability. And that's to get at the high-cost areas, and particularly the rural exchanges like Mr. Lindstrom's, get some additional money to deal with that. The other side to that, then, now you have these people who are responsible for delivering the phone to whoever you can get, and they have an assigned territory to deal with that, are the competitive providers. Any telephone company in the state, and ILEC can become a competitive provider in another company is ILEC's territories, and in fact, Mr. Lindstrom's company is co-op is certified through the PUC to be a CLEC in a couple of other areas, including, I believe, either has one pending, whatever, in the neighboring co-op. The issue becomes then is, you know, you're getting into the competing. If you, as I see this bill, and frankly, it's not entirely clear to us what the bill is intended to do. It's clear now that it seems to be to get at some kind of tax problem, which is certainly outside of your regulatory authority and that you delegated us. But it appears to us that what this does is, in effect, you're allowing them to decide where their service territory is going to be, in effect become an ILEC anywhere in the state where they wish to be, so you have competing ILECs there and you may have some access for funds. There are other technical issues that go along with that when you have an ILEC, things like the numbering system, cross-subsidization between the CLEC and the ILEC, which will interfere with how we figure different access charges and things like that, interconnection fees, so and frankly the USF, whether they're eligible for USF Universal Service Fund funding or not in those areas. So it's confusing to us. Frankly, the tax issues aside, and that's not our issue, we're not sure why there's a problem with any one company that wants to become a competitor in another territory, why they need a law change to do that. Anyone can. And as I said, we have 33 ILECs in the state, and we have over 100. In fact, we almost have 200 CLECs that are trying to provide service or providing some level of service in the state. So the current law, I don't believe, is a barrier to competition. I think Mr. Lindstrom said he's aggressively competing against Quest in the Quest territories. I know that he's serving in some of the neighboring co-op territories, so I'm not exactly sure what the problem is, other than taxes and changing the definition. And again, the way this law has changed here would allow, normally the direction that you have given the PUC is that we assign territories. What this seems to do is it seems to say that a co-op, through the independent action of their board of directors, can choose to designate any area within the state as part of their service territory. In fact, they could come into the PUC and give us, say, see this map of the state of Oregon? This is our service territory. And by this change of law, the PUC and anybody else would have no challenge to that. They would be granted. So that's really some of the issues on that. And again, I want to be real clear that the language to us is somewhat vague. It uses some different terms, and it confuses the co-op statutes, I think, with the telecommunications statutes. Some of this, quite frankly, you heard my pitch before on Senate Bill 17 that we have in front of you to create an interim committee. That's the kind of thing. These are just a small sample of the kinds of confusions that the legislature really needs to deal with, but I would urge you to deal with it in a comprehensive fashion, not on the piecemeal. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Chairman Byer. I think you were helpful. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. With that, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 309, and with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.